We're pleased to welcome Congressman Josh Gottheimer to this show. He is, in my observation, one of the best and brightest in Congress. He prides himself on being a centrist Democrat, indeed, passionately centrist. Born and raised in New Jersey, he attended University of Pennsylvania undergrad, Oxford University in England, and is a graduate of Harvard Law School. I wish I had a dollar for every person who says they went to Harvard Law School. He has been a speechwriter for President Bill Clinton and worked with the presidential campaigns of John Kerry and Hillary Clinton. I first met Josh 23 years ago when he was a summer associate at my law firm. Josh was elected to Congress, New Jersey's 5th Congressional District, anchored in Bergen County, first in 2016. He sits on the House Financial Services and Intelligence Committees. Most important, since his election to Congress 10 years ago, as a prominent member and former co-chair of the Problem Solvers Caucus, Josh has put problem solving over partisan politics to get stuff done for the people of his district and the state of New Jersey. Josh, welcome to WBGO.
Jay, that was beyond kind of you. And now I feel like I owe you one back, because it is an enormous honor to be here. I can't believe how long we've known each other. And one of my favorite moments of actually seeing you was right after I was elected. You won't remember this, but right after I was elected, I was in Hakeem Jeffries' office, and you came in. You were still the secretary of Homeland Security, and it was the last months of President Obama's tenure. And you came in and spent time with us, and it was, I remember, because I've known you for a long time, since obviously the law firm days, but also when you were the same, because you were secretary of what was your other job? Oh yeah, look at that.
There's the picture. Photo. Yes.
Yes.
Well, it's actually amazing. In the speaker's office.
Oh, it's in the speaker's office. You're right. Well, yeah, Hakeem was there, though, right? Wasn't Hakeem there? I remember.
Yeah, he's in the picture. That photo? Yes, absolutely.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Look at that. Yes, right. I remember that so well. It's unbelievable. Anyway, so I've always been a huge fan of yours, and the way you actually have brought people together in all your jobs and all your hats that you've worn, and serving as Secretary of Homeland Security, which is enormously challenging role in these moments. So thank you for your...
Well, fortunately, I'm not governing in these moments. I have to make it clear to everyone, anytime, as you know, you say the words Homeland Security, a lot of people see red. So I have to point out that I was Secretary of Homeland Security for President Obama.
President Obama.
But anyway, I want to note that, and I do this for when I interview public servants, this interview was pre-recorded on May 6th because of the pace of national events. I feel obliged to do that. Josh, you are a prominent member, former co-chair of the Problem Solvers Caucus in the House of Representatives. Could you just spend a minute talking about the mission of the Problem Solvers Caucus?
Sure. So when I got to Congress, I got elected in 16, so started serving in 17, Jay. And I really believed, going back to my time working for President Clinton, that the best governing happens when both sides actually work together. And even if they don't get 100% of what they want, they get 80% of what they want, and they take the win for the country and move forward. Something President Clinton taught us, and something that I believed in deeply. You know, when I ran in a first got elected, my district had been a Republican district for 84 years in northern New Jersey. So you know, this is a place where if you're extreme on one side or the other, you're not winning. And the guy I beat was too extreme and didn't make sense. People just want you to get stuff done for them. And so I ran as a problem solver and got to Congress and said, we got to talk to each other more. We got to work together. So I helped start up and reboot this group called the Problem Solvers. And so I co-founded it with a guy named Tom Reed from New York. And we got 10 Democrats and 10 Republicans initially in a room and said, hey, what if we actually agreed, A, not to campaign against each other, right, to not work against each other politically, and B, decide to get together every week and figure out where are the places that we could actually legislate and govern and where we could agree and see if we can put deals together, agreements together, so we can get legislation across the finish line. And now the group, I chaired the organization for 4 terms. And now the group, and now vice chair it, but has 34 Democrats and 34 Republicans in it. And we've been over the years responsible for helping get done some of the most significant legislation in these in over the and over the last decade, where whether it's budgets, whether it's the infrastructure bill, whether it's about money for resources for Ukraine, all these agreements we've helped get done by actually sitting in a room, not screaming and yelling at each other, but figuring out how we can build relationships, build trust, and govern.
I recall you told me once that if you join the Problem Solvers Caucus, you make a commitment that if a certain percentage of the caucus agrees on something, you have to go along. Is that correct?
Yes, we made a series of bylaws. First thing we did when I became chair and back in after getting elected was we put together a series of bylaws. And one of the core bylaws was, besides decorum toward one another, was that when we got to 75% agreement, you agreed to vote as a block, which
Right.
means that you have a lot more power. You might imagine if you show up with 68 votes than if you do with one vote.
Of course.
Especially in these tight majorities. And you get three times, we call them, three times you can pull the ripcord over the 2-year Congress, where you just say, hey, listen, that thing we're agreeing on, it's so inimical to, to my district and issues that I believe in. I just can't do it. But we endorse all these bills all the time, not just big stuff, but also smaller stuff. And the expectation is that you'll get on board when we endorse.
So, as we speak on May 6th, 2026, what's happening with DHS funding?
Well, as of today, the good news is, I believe it's good news, is that last week we agreed as a Congress to end the shutdown for most of Homeland, meaning everything except funding Border Patrol and ICE, which we've kept. We've like broken that piece off separately because we have not been able to come to an agreement of operation of how really the administration, in my opinion, should be doing things in a different approach. But we funded the rest of Homeland, which includes things like the TSA, which is at the airports, as you know, and FEMA and CISA, which deals with cybersecurity. So many. What, Jay? There's what, 21 departments? How many?
It's actually what we used to say is 22 components.
22 components.
Now, a component can be as large as TSA, or it can be an office of 10 people. So I just let you in on a little secret there.
Got it. But there's a lot of components, right?
There's a lot of components,
I mean,
exactly,
I
right.
can't, my friend my friend I've told you, Mark Wayne Mullen, who is the secretary who is a very close friend of mine. We disagree on a lot more probably than we agree on, but I'm sorry, but anyway, so he and I Mark Wayne Mullen and I when he got in, one of the big things he told me immediately was, I can't believe how many different parts there are of this that I didn't even know about. And I was thinking, he started going through some of the responsibility, the daily responsibility, and it just gave me even more respect for what you had to grapple with daily. Imagine.
Well, I noted that there were a number of Democrats in the Senate confirmation vote who just didn't vote. And I took that as a sign, hey, we like this guy, but we don't want to vote against him, and we don't want to vote for him either. So,
Yeah, politically, it's a rough. It's you know, it's a, it's bipartisanship is not exactly as popular as it should be, in my opinion, in this country right now. Governing isn't. Screaming, yelling gets more attention, and I think a lot of senators said, and especially because of the administration's approach to ICE and CBP under former Secretary Noem and her approach, which I disagree with a lot of how the way she handled things.
right.
That led this to be even DHS to be even more political than it should be. And Mark Wayne has sort of said to me, he's really trying to take the politics out of this and reorient things a bunch. And I talked to him, I spoke to him a lot about it. And I'm optimistic that he's gonna take a different tact. And so far it seems that way, but we'll see.
Well, in my experience, if you're out of the news and nobody's talking about you, if you're Secretary of DHS, that's a good thing. It means you're getting your job done.
Jay, I'm going to tell him you said that because that's exactly what his goal, he told me, was. He's like, I don't want us to be in the news. I want us to
Right.
do our job.
Now, I take it the immigration components that you talked about earlier, ICE and CBP, are being funded with multi-year money from the Big Beautiful Bill. That's what I've heard, at least.
That's correct. They're using funding from the big, beautiful bill, or I don't like to call it that. I call it the, big ugly bill or big effed up bill in Jersey. That's what I like to call it. But yes, that's they're taking some resources and able to move that over. That's not going to last forever. And but their goal, what they're doing now, is they're passing a separate partisan package that they can do through a procedure called reconciliation, which
Right.
they don't need any Democrats in the Senate. It could be a partisan vote, purely partisan vote, and they're going to try to fund it, those other two departments, that way.
Right. So, what are you hearing from your constituents these days about most? What's on their minds?
I think the number one thing on people's minds is about something related to the cost of life, right? And that, but that's it's a broad topic in some ways, but it quickly gets to a fine point when they, right now they're talking about gas prices. Someone came up to me just the other day, and said, I paid $80 to fill up my tank. It cost literally half that 2 months ago, right? And you got the average price in Jersey now for a gallon, I think about 452, 453, something like that. And that's a heck of a lot more than, as you know, when you tried to fill up just weeks ago, and that is a huge impact on your pocketbook. You add to that energy bills, utility prices that people are paying in New Jersey, which in over the last 2 years are up about 50%, 45 to 50%, depending where you live. Which you're on a fixed income, you're on any kind of income. That's not like a couple nickels extra. That is real money in your pocket. Then you add the impact of all the tariffs and what they've had, inflationary impact they've had on everything you buy, plus food, groceries, rent, childcare. We have the third highest in the country, our childcare. So, and then I didn't even mention the T word, which I hate, taxes. And you add taxes to the mix, and people are just feeling like they're getting killed from every direction here. And
Right.
that's honestly, Jay, that is what people talk to me about the most. They'll bring up other stuff like the World Cup and other things like that these days, but mostly, that's what they're talking to me about.
Several years ago, during Trump won, we got the federal deduction for state and local taxes in states like New Jersey was dramatically cut back, which means we're overall paying much higher taxes. Any hope of getting that somehow eliminated, amended, or what do you think?
Well, there's two things. Many of us, and you and I have talked about this before, have really been focused on first reversing what Trump did in his first term, where he gutted the state and local tax deduction, or SALT. And for those who, I'm sure everyone knows by now, but just in case, before you pay your federal taxes, used to be able to deduct what you paid in your state income tax and your property taxes, which New
Right.
Jersey got some of the highest property taxes in the
Gee, I
country.
didn't know that. Okay. All
Anyone
right.
listening knows that. And some of the highest income taxes in the country. As a result, that was capped at 10 grand, right? A couple. So went from being whatever you paid, and you're talking about in Bergen County, the median property tax is around 15 grand. So right there, you're over that $10,000 deduction. Forget your income tax. People's taxes on middle class families went way up across the state. A couple months ago, after many of us been fighting for this for years, they raised that cap now to $40,000, and phased it out at I think it's $500,000 of income. The caps out at that $40,000. Over 500,000 income, it goes back to the $10,000. But that helped a bunch of families. I just proposed that we get rid of something called the marriage penalty, meaning that if you file right now, if you file as a couple, you get that $40,000 total deduction that you could take. I think it should be $80,000 for a couple, right? So $40,000 a person. Because if you're an individual, you get 40,000. Why shouldn't two people get $80,000 if they're filing jointly? So that's what I've proposed. This is going to be a constant fight. The red states obviously are not big fans of the blue states, and those red states tend to support the Republicans more. So, as I've said, I'll bring up Oklahoma again, since we were just talking about Mark Wayne. I remember saying to him, "Hey, Mark Wayne, what do you think what's the median property tax in Oklahoma? And he's like, I'm not sure. So we look it up, and because we were fighting about salt, and I said, it's $1,200, like for the year, $1,200. I was like, so of course $10,000 seems like enough to you. It's
$1,200, no matter how much your
$1,200.
property, no matter how big your property is.
The median, that's the, you know, that was the median.
That's
It's
the
the median
median.
across, that's the median across the state, $1,200. By the way, in Mississippi, it's $750.
Right.
So for the year, that's the, by the way, that's their year's property tax. I said that's like a bar bill around here with some people.
Right, exactly. Right. So they're not rushing to help you out on salt, I guess. How concerned should we be about what Congress might be doing to Obamacare?
I mean, it's what they did to Obamacare, right? I mean, unfortunately, and many of us, and this is where the Problem Solvers Caucus and a bunch of us came together, and because the deduction, the ACA tax credit, this administration decided to gut that, to cut significantly the support and the tax credits families were able to get to help pay for their health insurance premiums. And they did. A bunch of us fought back and said, "You please do not cut this, right? Like you can't do this to families. They're already getting crushed on their healthcare premiums, and you know that's one of those affordability things we were just talking about, the cost things. And people, their health insurance premiums are up 20. A lot of people, I'm sure, if you ask, are up 20% over the last year or so. This is not like a small increase. And so these tax credits, many of us came together. We were able, actually, believe it or not, Jay, we got Democrats and Republicans in the House to force a vote on this issue. And we got it done in the House to keep the tax credit.
Right.
And the Senate refused to act on it. So people's premiums are way up. And I saw last week, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but millions and millions of people have already left Obamacare or the affordable, you know,
Right.
their health insurance coverage under Obamacare, because they just can't afford it anymore. And it's because it's since that tax deduction was eliminated, that tax credit was eliminated, and now people just don't have health insurance. And by the way, for people who think, well, that's not my problem, let me explain to you why it's your problem. People have to get care when they need it, as they should, and they go to the emergency room, and then you pay for it anyway. So
Yeah.
like it comes through to, you know, you're going to pay for this, if you know, and people should be able to afford their health insurance, you know, family
Yeah.
and children. So.
So let me ask you about one of my pet projects, which I consider a homeland security matter, the Gateway Tunnel, the railroad tunnel underneath the Hudson River into Penn Station from New Jersey, which
Yes.
is the choke point for the entire Northeast Corridor,
Yes.
and probably the busiest railroad tunnel in the nation, if not the world. What's happening with funding for the Gateway Tunnel?
20% of the GDP of the country goes through our region, and that these tunnels are critical to that. They're as people know, have been through those on the train under the Hudson. These things are more than 110 years old. They're literally falling apart, held together
Yes.
by Scotch tape and bubble gum.
Right.
We can't run a lot of trains that we want to capacity wise through them because one is often, there's two tubes, one in, one out. One of them's often down for repairs.
Believe me, as a former commuter, I know.
You
Yes.
know the deal, and it's brutal. The good news is, you know, and this is one of the things I'm most proud of, is the infrastructure bill, which I helped negotiate and pass. I got the slug of funding for the Gateway Train Tunnel. And that's a fun story about how that got negotiated. And Trump tried to cut, you know, in the beginning of his administration, he tried to hold up funding, and he's been messing with it. The good news, it appears that he's, after a lot of lawsuits and fighting, it appears that he's backed off the fight and has put the resources through to keep the project moving, because it's literally moving. There was a
Right.
bridge that's been completed, and
I
now.
know it's a beautiful bridge.
Right, you've seen it. We got the boring machines ready to roll, and you know there's been a lot of work done. And he was trying to hold it up, I think because of, you know, he's got some issues, I think, with Schumer, and I think this is
Right.
just like just a little petty fight. But we've got this handled now, and it seems like we're full steam ahead here.
Well, at one point he wanted the tunnel named the Trump Tunnel, didn't he?
I mean, by the way, a bunch of us offered that. I mean, I said, if you will fund this thing, this was before we got money, like this is his first term.
Absolutely.
Everybody was holding up. I was like, I don't care what you want to call it, just fund it.
I've said the exact same thing to President Trump during Trump won.
Oh, good.
Because guess what? How many people who ride a train see the name of a railroad tunnel? If it's across the top of the tunnel, who sees the face of the tunnel except maybe the
No
engineer?
one. Well, by the way,
Right.
Jay, this was the problem. I was in a meeting with him his first term, and we were making the argument to fund the tunnel. I think I was there with Cory and Senator Booker and others, and he says, "Well, I don't understand." He goes, "The problem if I spend all this money on this," he goes, "no one will see it." That was his argument. I said,
Yeah.
"What do you mean no one will see it?" He says, "Well, it's a tunnel, it's underground, so I'm spending all this money." And I was like, "Well, yeah, well, it's a tunnel, right?" So, and then somebody rightly goes, "Well, there'll be a lot of cranes during the construction." And then he perked up. He said, "Oh, there'll be, He's like, "Well," and then he goes, "Well, how many cranes?" So, when we were when I was working on negotiating the infrastructure bill, which, as I mentioned, helped fund this tunnel, so I was working with a gentleman named Bill Cassidy, who's a senator from Louisiana. Dr. Cassidy. Again, we may not agree on everything, but we've worked together on a bunch of things to get done. And he says, so we're sitting there negotiating, and he has his computer open. I have my laptop open, and we've got a spreadsheet of items that we're trying to fund. And he says, and then I see a line item, and he says, and it says oil well covers. And I said to him, the hell's an oil well cover? What do you need this? He's like, I need like 800 million or whatever it was. I can't remember the exact number for oil well covers. And I said, I don't, Jay, what? I said to him, well, Bill, why would anybody in New Jersey want to find an oil well cover? And then I hear him, he's looking through, and he looks at me and goes, what's this tunnel between New York? And he goes, you want resources investment between a tunnel between New York and New Jersey? He goes, you think that's going to sell in Louisiana? I was like, I love oil well covers. Sure.
It's good old-fashioned horse trading. I want to ask you about the current, I don't know whether to call it a war, ceasefire engagement in Iran. I heard somebody say the other day, if you're not totally confused, you're not paying attention. So, what's your take on what's happening in Iran and the Strait right now, as of May 6th, as I talk to you?
Yeah, and recognizing that I know this will air later, and there's so you could have we could this thing could change by the minute, because it appears that there's a term sheet going back and forth between us and Iran right now. Who knows? We've heard that a few times, so I'll put that asterisk out there. My general view on this is that Iran, the government of Iran, is an enemy of our country. Has been for decades, the regime there, and they've sought to undermine our freedom and our democracy. They've killed Americans. They're the leading state sponsor of terror with Hamas and Hezbollah and Palestinian Islamic Jihad and others. And they've obviously moved full steam ahead on the nuclear program, initially claiming they wanted it for energy purposes. Obviously, they've that's not. The evidence of enrichment levels that they've been focused on is clearly driving toward a nuclear weapon, which we believe, and this is public, that they could have, within weeks if they wanted one. It is Iran is no friend of our country, and hasn't been, given their relationship, not just with terrorist proxies, but with China and North Korea and Russia. I say all that to say that I feel zero sympathy with doing everything we can, with going after them, the government there, and after they killed tens of thousands of their own people, massacred them in over the last year, for standing up for freedom. But the president, in my opinion, has to say that he has done a poor job of at least communicating what the objectives are, the progress is, and what the goals are, is an understatement, both to the country and frankly to the Congress.
Right.
And as a member of the Intelligence Committee, I am it's not every it is he has not met the standard of briefing our committee. And of course, he has not formally briefed his administration has not formally briefed the Congress. We are now past the 60-day mark that the War Powers Act calls for, where the President of the United States,
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. It's more than just briefing Congress. There's this little provision in the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, that says Congress declares war, not the president. A little
correct,
down on the.
and the War Powers Act has been true, which you know has been whether it's a for even if it's not a formal declaration of war,
Yes.
because the president has you know has an, we declare war, but formally or if he asks for a declaration, he has not asked for an authorization of use of military force or an AUMF,
Correct.
and therefore in the sixth the War Powers Act of 72 triggers a 60-day period where the president has to come to us and say, I want an authorization of force or I want a declaration of war. Or he then has 30 days to wind down.
Yes,
And
to stop. Yeah. I was before I was Secretary of DHS, I was the senior legal official for the Department of Defense. So I know a little something about this. Do you think the War Powers Resolution is effectively a nullity?
yeah, I mean, if the War Powers, you're asking about the resolution or the War Powers Act?
The War Powers Resolution of 1973.
Oh, got it. Yeah, sorry. Yes, because there's we're also voting on, as you know, and have voted on several War Powers resolutions
Right, War Powers Resolutions pursuant to the
that are
73 law, right?
pursuant to the
Right.
law. Yeah, I mean, but the problem with it, and you as given the legal position you held in the military, presidents have all, and both Democratic and Republican presidents have found all crafty ways around the War Powers Act.
I have to
And
confess that, yes.
so, I think in a lot of ways, I'd say it's supposed to be really, at this point, a forcing mechanism, in my opinion, to actually come to the Congress and brief us properly and ask for an authorization. That to me is, at this point, given that presidents find the loopholes around the law. This president, though, has said, well, his loopholes he's finding right now because it's not he, other presidents have you said, well, there was an authorization of force going back here that I can use for this. This president is saying, I've
I'm
stopped.
familiar with that too.
Yes,
Yeah.
I'm sure you are. This president has said, I'm stopping the clock, right? We have these day, we have these ceasefires. And
Yep.
these days where there's no conflict, they don't count. Of
Right.
course, a blockade as an act of war, as you know, also. So I believe that does keep the clock. Many of us believe that does keep the clock ticking. And toward that 60 days, the president and his people have a different interpretation of that clock.
Yes, there have been various different clever arguments advanced over the years that what we're doing is not quote unquote hostilities, and therefore the clock is not running because, it's not one war. It's just each separate drone strike is its own war. It's intermittent. Or that my favorite one is it's not hostilities because they're not shooting back at me. It can only be hostilities if both sides are shooting at each other.
If it's two ways, yeah.
Right, exactly. So, last question, Josh. Being a House member, it's not easy. It's got to be incredibly challenging on both a political and personal level. You got to run for re-election every 2 years. You got to go to Washington like 2.5, 3 days a week away from your family. And your time is not your own. You have to go vote on a moment's notice. And you're challenged by the politics of it all. What year after year over the last 10 years, what has kept you going in this job?
Man, you make it sound so glamorous. listen, you sound like my wife. I listen. I still wake up and believe it is a huge honor to be able to serve. And the good news is, I still get a lot done. And that is very heartening. You know, whether you're helping somebody, helping a veteran out with getting into a nursing home that they, you know, after serving our great country, or you know, helping some with their Social Security, or frankly, doing what I do all the time, which is getting a bipartisan agreement, a piece of legislation done, and being able to be in the room for Jersey at those key moments. I find that incredibly, frankly, that's still incredibly fulfilling personally, and I believe it's a huge honor and a gift that people have given me here. So, you know, it's tough though. I won't claim it's easy right now, you know, because everyone's, you know, people are angrier. It feels like people are angrier than ever, because of you add social media and cable news and the partisanship, and there's not, as I said earlier, there's not a lot of reward for people like me who try to find agreement. And Jay, I know that was always your approach as well, right? Someone like trying to figure out how to get something done. And we need people willing to do that still. There's few of us. I feel like a unicorn these days, in some of the approach to governing that I take, but it's got to happen. And the country's got to run. And you can't just have people who want to scream and yell and tweet and decide that accomplishment is how many followers you have on Twitter. That to me doesn't count.
Okay, Congressman Josh Gottheimer, Democrat from New Jersey, thank you for your time and thank you for joining us at WBGO.
Jay, thanks. It's a great country. So thanks for serving.
Thank you. Same to you.
Thanks.